It's July 15th, 1981. At long last, my first day as an actual resident in radiation oncology, the culmination of a dream of practicing medicine and the beginning of a new path. The first patient that I am given is a 39-year-old woman undergoing treatment for advanced lung cancer. She has only a couple of weeks to go before finishing the treatment that was planned for her. Her chances of cure are small, maybe 20%, so the treatment is aggressive. I'm working under the supervision of an experienced attending physician at UF and Shands, and will take the place of another resident who's just graduated and see the patient through her treatment. Her name is Jean. I know that I have so much to learn. Most patients with lung cancer have long histories of smoking. As I prepare to meet Jean by reviewing her chart, I'm surprised to learn that she's never been a smoker. No one can tell me why this happened to her, and I cannot find anything in the literature except the mention that it sometimes happens. I wonder, as I prepare to meet her, whether she's angry to have cancer that usually strikes only smokers, whether her prognosis will be different, and whether I'll be able to answer her questions. When I meet her, I'm struck by the premature gray streaks running through her hair and the depth of her brown eyes. There's warmth and friendliness, but also anxiety. I discover she's lost some weight from the side effects of treatment. There's little that we can do about that because the radiation has to go through her skin and her throat to get to the lung cancer. At the end of her checkup, though, the only question she asks is whether I like to cook. She wants to bring me something. The next week, in a brown paper bag, she brought two glass pie plates. To me, this was very curious. The gifts were not new, and I understood that she was giving me something that was hers, something that she'd used. I was worried that she was giving me something she needed more than I did, but I knew she wanted to give it to me, so I thanked her and told her I appreciated it because I love to make pies. The anxiety was still there in her eyes. So it was then that I felt I could ask her if there was something else that was bothering her. It was her children, she said. She was worried about her children. There were five of them. Her husband had left her several years before, so she was the sole support. Since she'd been sick, she was unable to work and unable to pay her bills and was going to be evicted at the end of the month. She was giving her things away, and she did not know where she and her children would go.
We're going to tell you what happened to Jean a little bit later on. But first, I'd like to ask you all a couple of questions. First of all, would you raise your hand if you've ever personally dealt with cancer, if you've had it? I recognize some of my patients out there. Thank you for coming. Now, will all of you who have a family member, had a family member who had cancer, raise your hand as well? So if you look around, you see a lot of people. And then let's also include people who've had friends and colleagues. So everybody. So a lot of people, you'll see well over 50%, probably 50 to 75%, which is not surprising because cancer strikes about one out of every three or four Americans, cancer other than skin cancers. And it's the second most common cause of death in the U.S. It affects men and women, children, all ages, races, all ethnic and socioeconomic backgrounds. Nancy and I have been physicians at the University of Florida taking care of cancer patients for about 30 years now. Dan asked us to talk to you about how our spiritual and professional lives have intersected. So today we'll start off by telling you a little bit about how our paths joined and then share with you some of the problems that we've had, that we faced along the way, and made us acutely aware of God and our need for His involvement in our lives. The problem of bad things that happen to good people, the problem of uncertainties when we try to figure out how best to take care of a cancer patient, and then the twin problems of success and failure.
These issues are probably best dealt with real stories. And so the framework is real stories about some of our patients. I've come to believe that our lives are like a tapestry. There are strands of color and patterns that appear early on, which are part of the big picture, but we may not see that until the tapestry is finished. Those strands of color may disappear for a while and then reemerge later in new and larger patterns as the piece progresses. Tracing those colors, looking for the patterns, studying the picture, tells us something of the weaver. For this reason, we decided to start our stories at the beginning, tracing the early passions and patterns that led us on the path to become cancer physicians. For me, it's not too surprising that most of my young years were spent on a farm in Arkansas, given that my great-grandparents had traveled to Arkansas as pioneers by Conestoga wagon, and their children, my grandparents, had stayed there as subsistence farmers. From an early age, I loved the farm, the trees, the out-of-doors, felt like home. I treasured the solitude, but I didn't feel alone. Our church was a crude-cut brownstone Methodist church with deeply stained glass windows showing Jesus in various scenes from the Bible. I learned the songs there first that would stay with me for the rest of my life, reminding me of who I was when in strange places it might have been easy to forget. In that small town of 2,500 during ninth grade, biology and chemistry opened a whole new world for me. While I loved the macrocosm of the farm and nature, I loved the microcosm of the cell and the molecule. And like everyone else in our community, I loved our country doctor. So by 15, I knew deep inside and passionately that I wanted to understand how the human body works and that I wanted to be a doctor. Many years later, in a faraway place, an older woman who was waiting patiently on God's call told me that God gives us deep passions and desires that only He can fill. Some months later, when I turned 16, finished 10th grade, my family left the farm to move to another city. I'd not remembered moving before. All the friends I'd known were gone. After a few weeks, I went into a deep depression. I couldn't eat. I couldn't leave home. Lost interest in everything. And one day, alone in the house, I felt drawn to the garage where a ping pong table was set up, and I had had many happy hours playing ping pong with my dad. I sat down on the step, feeling overwhelming loneliness and hopelessness, and suddenly I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that I was not alone. I couldn't see anyone, but I knew I was not alone, and I was not afraid. As I sat there, not moving, my mind was flooded with the name of Christ. It was a new name for me, and in our church we always referred to Jesus, not Christ. So I knew I'd been given a name to call upon by a real person, by a friend. And from that moment on, I never felt alone again. Came out of the depression, walked steadily on the next 2 years along a path I knew was my path. I've often wondered what it might have been like if I had been able to continue straight on that path. Would I have gone into a different kind of medicine? Would I have ended up in a different place? What was lost when I stepped off that path, marrying the wrong person, a good person, but not the right person, and not the right time, so that medical school was delayed? But during the delay, I met missionaries from Wycliffe in the Amazon Basin who taught me something about the gospel, fellowship, and faith. Later, when my husband left, my first reaction was to be angry with God. It took some time, more mistakes, much soul searching, before I understood that He had been there all along, teaching me, blessing me with new friends, even as I trudged along the wrong path, patiently waiting to lead me back to the right path, the one that He'd chosen for me. The next year I met Bill, and this coming June we will have been married and practiced medicine together for 30 years. We've been blessed beyond imagining with our daughters, Marissa and Elena, and with the privilege of being part of the lives of our patients, part of this community, and part of Trinity.
You left out the part about the best day in your life when you met me. Go figure.
I said there were a few more mistakes.
Well, anyway, I'm used to talking to large groups of people, but I'm used to talking about data, and I don't use notes. And I hadn't planned on using notes tonight, but Nancy said that it wasn't okay for me to get up here and do stream of consciousness. So anyway, this is a little out of my comfort zone. It's kind of like the time I gave a lecture in French, and I don't speak French. And when I was in church a few weeks ago, when Troy gave the sermon about volunteering, I actually thought about tonight. And when he talked about the guy who unlocked the church doors, I thought that sounded very appealing. But at any rate, as Dan mentioned, I grew up here in Gainesville. I actually grew up in the Presbyterian Church with Preacher Gordon, for those of you all who remembered him. My dad was a statistician. Both my parents were Christians and active in the church, and my brother and I were expected to go to church regularly. My grandmother died of pancreatic cancer when I was about 16, and so at that point I started thinking about medicine and about oncology in particular. But my dad, the statistician, really was very interested in me boning up on math and probability. So I was drilled in math and probability. And when I was a kid and we'd go to Daytona Beach in the summers to see my grandparents, I would be in the front seat with my dad, and my brother and my mom would be in the back seat. And so all the way to Daytona and all the way back, he would ask me probability questions. And at any rate, I majored in statistics in undergrad, briefly thought about graduate school until I took a graduate-level math course, and it became apparent that that was probably not a great idea. And so I went into medical school and initially thought about surgical oncology, then met my future boss on the tennis court and went into radiation oncology, which I really didn't know much about at the time. It's a specialty in medicine that deals almost exclusively with cancer patients, and it's a challenge because the patients have a serious illness, usually life-threatening, and you're either trying to cure them, in which case you generally have one shot. Usually second time around, the odds are usually much worse, and either that or you're trying to relieve significant symptoms caused by the cancer. Radiotherapy is a very powerful treatment modality. It's nonspecific, so it can damage normal tissues as well as get rid of the cancer. With certain cancers, most patients are cured. With others, only a few people are cured. And in any given case, while it's possible to have some idea of the likelihood of success, you really never know for sure, and the treatment carries a risk of injuring the patient. The probability of curing the patient often guides how aggressive the treatment plan is going to be. So, for example, if the odds of cure are not very good, sometimes we're willing to take more risks in order to have a chance of getting rid of the malignancy. And that means that one of the things that we do is we practice evidence-based medicine, so we track our patients and try to figure out the likelihood of cure, the likelihood of a complication. During my internship, when I started in radiation oncology, I met Nancy, my life partner, and now with our two daughters, five dogs, all dogs are female. I live in the deep end of the estrogen pool. I'm very happy there. I haven't had to think since. And so now what we're going to do is talk about the three things I mentioned, why bad things happen to good people, dealing with the probabilities, uncertainties in medicine, and the twin problems of success and failure.
So why do bad things happen to good people? Imagine with me for a second an endless sea of green trees below the wings of a plane, a silver ribbon of a major river in the Amazon basin, and a narrow airstrip leading up to a Wycliffe missionary base called Leman Kocha. About 40 people live there, including linguists working on Bible translations, some medical folks, some aviators, some teachers. Among the programs there were courses for indigenous men and women in Spanish, reading and writing, carpentry, basic medical skills. As I stepped off the DC-3 that day onto the landing strip, I'll never forget the sudden blast of hot, humid, musty air that characterizes the rainforest and the many friendly faces that greeted us. For the next year, I completely gave up any effort at all whatsoever to control my hair. The curls and the waves were all on their own, and except for church, I rarely wore anything other than jeans and long-sleeved shirts to protect against the sun and the mosquitoes, and always rubber boots. Wycliffe had a history of facilitating scientific projects, so we were there at Wycliffe's hospitality for the year to study a family of butterflies that lived only in the tropics. and we found ourselves in a paradise. There were butterflies everywhere, bright bits of color flitting through the air. Even at night, when I closed my eyes, the colors were still there beneath my eyelids, precluding sleep. After a few weeks, there was a knock at the door in a really hot afternoon. It was Mark, a white, mustached, merry-eyed, 60-year-old former insurance salesman who now was a missionary running the Carpentry program. He'd come to see how we were doing. When he realized how hot it was inside the tiny tin-roofed house, he left and returned immediately with an electric fan. Months later, when he and Phyllis, his wife of only a few years, went on furlough for a few months, they invited us to stay in their beautiful home on the lake. And I had the use of Phyllis's kitchen, which was replete with Mark's inventions, a central mahogany Lazy Susan on the dining room table to facilitate feeding their many guests, a mechanical slicer for the hard yuca, a special raised cutting board with a hole that set over a bowl. He adored Phyllis, whom he'd met late in life, where she served as a missionary educator and had undoubtedly watched her in the kitchen and challenged himself with finding ways to make her work easier. It was a few years later when Phyllis, who was a native of Stark, came to visit me in Gainesville when I was a fourth-year medical student. She developed back pain. The doctors in Quito had removed a growth from her spine and told her things would be okay. I insisted that she stay long enough to see a specialist at Shands. I felt good that I was in a position to direct her to someone I considered to be the best in the world. To my surprise, after review of her x-rays and pathology, she was again told nothing to worry about. But a year later, the pain returned and the growth had recurred. She came back to Gainesville. When the tumor was removed a second time, it was clear that it was malignant. The surgeon thought he got it all and nothing else would be needed. A year later, the cancer came back again, and this time radiation was in the option, but it didn't work. The tumor proceeded to cause great pain and loss of function, and she died in Shands. I was overwhelmed with loss, pain, guilt that medicine had not been able to take care of my friend. Strangely, though, Mark, while he was very, very sad, accepted that Phyllis was gone. He was grateful to have been blessed late in life with almost 10 years of her love and partnership. For months, I went over and over what had happened to her and wondered if something else should have been done. Why had everyone in Phyllis's path been blind of what was happening? Why had God let this happen? How could Mark accept it? At some point in time, the improbability of each improbable step along Phyllis's path those last few years struck me as just too improbable to be chance. It had been Phyllis's time. No matter what I wanted to make happen, I was not the one in charge. It was simply Phyllis's time to go home. The point I came to see is that these things happen, which from our human perspective can only appear as tragic and unjust, but God is always there, always in control, always faithful. It's not always for us, though, to see things from his perspective or to understand his ways.
How do we deal with the uncertainty that our treatment plan for a patient is ideal, or at least the best that we can do? Let me tell you about one of my patients, a gentleman named Miller from Toronto. He was about 70 years old. He was a successful businessman, a very thoughtful person. And we got to know him and his wife, June, quite well. He had an unusually aggressive skin cancer that involved the nerves and extended back to the base of his skull. And it was close to his optic nerves, which are the nerves of the eyes and are essential for vision. Because of the location, the tumor could not be removed surgically, and we had to choose between treating him aggressively with radiotherapy and adequately covering the tumor completely with about a 10% risk of permanent blindness, or underdosing part of the tumor, avoiding the high risk of blindness, and accept a high chance of a recurrence that would not be salvageable. At best, the chance of curing him is about 50%, even with the risk of blindness. And unfortunately, you do not have the time or the luxury of spending a lot of time making the decision. And even if you did, the choices don't change. You also can't allow it to paralyze you so that you can't take care of your other patients and your family. And Miller and I discussed the options in detail and, as usual, went with the aggressive treatment. their risk blindness. He did not develop blindness, but despite the aggressive radiation, developed a recurrence several years later and died from the cancer.
Nicole was about 16 years old when she came to the Radiation Oncology Department at Shands. It was about 1998. She was a beautiful young high school gymnast from Fort Lauderdale who had developed some pain in her low back that just wouldn't go away. X-rays showed a massive tumor arising from the bones of the pelvis. Biopsy showed osteosarcoma, a really aggressive type of bone tumor. The standard treatment was surgery. With surgery, she would have had a 40 to 50% chance of cure. Her parents had taken her to see surgeons all over the country, and all had recommended exactly the same thing. The surgery was her only chance, but it would leave her with a colostomy, a urinary bag, unable to walk, unable to have children. That would be the only chance for cure, though. Nicole refused the treatment, and her parents stood by her, knowing that they would lose her beloved daughter if no treatment were given. She was sent to our department as a last resort. My colleagues saw her, reiterated the recommendation for surgery, and explained to her that if radiation were given instead of surgery, there would be so much damage to the bladder and the bowel and the ovaries that she would likely lose all of the organs that surgery would take. As they started to leave the department, dejected but unwilling to accept those probabilities, they asked, "Isn't there anything else?" My colleague knew about a new radiation oncology program in California. There was no data yet, no track record, just some promise that maybe, just maybe, cancers might be cured with a little bit less toxicity. So in 1998, Nicole received proton therapy at Loma Linda University. 2 years ago, she graduated from pharmacy school. She's never had any problems in walking. She'll be able to have children. She's cured. What were the chances that a young girl would say no to the recommendations of surgeons and specialists across the country, defy the odds, and end up finding the only place in the world at that time that could have given her this treatment? How many improbabilities added together does it take to make a miracle? And how many miracles does it take before we see the hand of God?
And so finally, how do we deal with the twin problems of success and failure? Do we own it? Is it due to probability, simply random events? Or does God determine what happens? Or is it something in between? It's another story. I have a patient named Walter, who's from south of here in the Ocala National Forest, who developed a very advanced head and neck cancer. And this was about 8 or 9 years ago, and he had a long history of smoking heavily and drinking heavily, and it's likely that his lifestyle would increase the odds of him getting the cancer. Chance of curing him was remote, and I treated him with a moderate dose of radiation to try to palliate the symptoms. And lo and behold, the cancer went away and stayed gone for 3.5 years, and then it came back in his throat. And so I decided to throw another Hail Mary and treated him again with another modest dose of radiation. And even more remarkable, the cancer went away and never came back. And he's still alive and fishing in the Ocala National Forest. The odds of this sort of outcome are less than 1 in 100. Why him? God had other plans. Another patient, Wally from Ocala, came in, also very advanced head and neck cancer. Went through a very aggressive course of radiotherapy and chemotherapy. Looked as though the cancer had not gone away completely, and I had a really very sad conversation with him and his family, and he entered the hospice program, and then he flunked out because he didn't die. And it turned out, thankfully, that I was wrong. The cancer slowly went away, and he is alive today, about 10 or 11 years out, and just saw him recently. Why? God had other plans.
Then there's Sylvia, who was in her early 40s with two beautiful daughters aged 2 and 7 after trying for years to have children when she felt a lump in her breast. Mastectomy showed not only advanced breast cancer, but also metastases to 31 of the 33 lymph nodes. For many oncologists at that time, the presence of just 10 positive lymph nodes was tantamount 2, distant metastases, no chance of cure, and certain death from breast cancer. She told me that her doctor said to her, take the chemotherapy and the radiation, but get your things in order, because there's no chance of cure or hope. So when she came to my office in 1987, she was understandably distraught. She needed me to say that I could cure her, and I couldn't do that. I told her, though, that I would fight with her and that I was going to try to help her become an old lady. She was able to calm down a bit and move forward. So for the next 6 months, she went through extensive radiation and chemotherapy. Her oldest daughter graduated from college in about 2002 and now works in New York as a film director. Her baby graduated from college in 2007 and now works in children's oncology. It's been 23 years, and she's still alive and wondering when she's going to be an old lady. So with this case, nothing is impossible with God. Some of you may have seen the 2006 movie, The Guardian, with Kevin Costner and Ashton Kutcher. Costner is a veteran Coast Guard rescue diver who's sent in to rescue people who are drowning in the sea after a ship capsizes. And Kutcher is a rookie determined to be greater than Costner, to save more lives than Costner has saved. So he asked Costner over and over again, what's the number? How many lives has he saved? Costner won't answer. At the end of the movie, right before Costner makes his last save, he finally gives Kutcher the answer, but it's not the answer that Kutcher was looking for. It's not the number of lives he saved. It's the number he lost. Maybe it's human nature to leave the rest of the sheep behind and to go in search.
Okay, yeah. This is where I step in. Okay, for the one that's lost, because maybe it's human nature to remember the failures more than the successes, to dwell on them, sometimes to the detriment of others. This is a preface to another story, Kay, Kim, similar to Nicole. This beautiful 17-year-old high school star basketball player who developed some hip pain that wouldn't go away. X-rays showed something thought to be benign. Time passed. The pain didn't go away. More X-rays showed progression, and it didn't look benign anymore. It was a Ewing sarcoma. While the overall prognosis was at best 50-50, this tumor, unlike Nicole's, usually did not require surgery, but could be controlled locally with radiation and very aggressive chemotherapy. Because of the site, there'd be significant side effects, both acute and as well as late side effects. But what could be done to increase the chance of cure? Surgery, a difficult decision to make because of the lack of clear evidence for a benefit, and the probable increased morbidity. I advised against it, citing the best sources and evidence that I could. She first received chemotherapy, then radiation, then more chemo, and a bone marrow transplant. And after overcoming the substantial acute effects, things appeared to go well for a while, and then the cancer came back in the bone near the original site. No one with such a recurrence had ever been cured when that had happened. Would the surgery have made a difference? Would the surgeon have even taken the adjacent bone where the disease recurred or had an operation been performed? For months and months, the questions came back to me over and over again. Sometimes a physician, is it much of a risk in the case of a failure as in the case of a success for taking on too much responsibility for the outcome? Unable to deal with the loss, it was many years before I, Nancy, could take care of children again. So, in conclusion, why do bad things happen to good people? We don't know. Bad things eventually happen to all of us, as Dan pointed out one time. I remember one of your sermons. But undeniably, some people have more than others. And often from our viewpoint, life is not fair. Back to the story of Jean we started with. Jean died. Her kids went into foster care. But God's in charge, and maybe he picks his prettiest flowers first. How do we know that our plan is the best that we can do? We don't. We do the best that we can and ultimately ask the question, what would we do if it was us or someone in our family, and do that, and accept that we can never know for sure. How do we handle the outcomes, both the good and the bad? We accept that God's in charge and that we're used by him to take care of cancer patients. We don't know for sure why the treatment works for some and not for others. When the cancer comes back and a patient dies, we lose a little bit of ourselves. When they do well, we feel great. And on the balance, we come out ahead. Thanks for coming.